Welcome to Improv Interviews with Margot Escott, a psychotherapist in Naples, Florida, who is using her 35 years of experience to develop improvisation programs, benefiting and improving the lives of those with emotional and physical challenges. Improv Interviews brings together the world's leading improvisational theater masters, founders, and innovators who are using improvisation therapeutically in unique and surprising ways. With great guests that include legends like Ed Asner and Aretha Sills, you're sure to learn something new about improvisation. This is Improv Interviews with your host, Margot Escott.
Well, today I'm really excited to bring a wonderful guest that I finally met in person at the Fanatics Salon in Los Angeles and got to see her perform and do improv with some other wonderful players. And you know her from screen and TV and an improv legend, Jane Morris. Hi, Jane.
Hi.
So it's really wonderful to be here. I think this is our third podcast, and we've talked about your background a little bit about that, but you're really an actor and you've got incredible credits. I was looking at a lot of the things you've been in, like, you know, Veep. And one that I really liked was the Drew Carey Show. And it was
That was fun.
Nora O'Darty.
And you had a recurring role on that, yeah.
And end up selling, Tupperware or something?
I don't remember.
It was a while back. You go way back for a young person, like your first screen credit was 1986, I think. So where were you living then?
Chicago. I think my first screen credit is Nothing in Common.
Right.
Yeah. And I was still at Second City then.
Okay.
But we had Nathan, our little boy. He was about a year and a half old, I think, when we did that. So we took him and a babysitter with us. You know, when you do a movie, they have to fly you first class. And we had to come to LA. But we had to bring a babysitter. So what we did is... we didn't fly first class. We split the tickets up, so we had a ticket for the babysitter.
Wonderful. That's very creative. You improvised with that ticket, didn't you, Jane?
Yeah, and then we split our per diem. It was such a good per diem. We split it up between the three of us.
Oh, that's fantastic. Nothing in Common, yeah. And who was in that anyway? Was that...
Jackie Gleason and Tom Hanks. And
Jackie
it was Tom Hanks first... Like, I'm not on TV. He was doing, Bosom Buddies?
Bosom Buddies, yeah.
Yeah. That was his first movie, I think, unless he did some low-budget thing no one knows about, which is possible.
So when you were growing up in Quincy, Illinois, did you have aspirations of being an actor or a writer or a director or any of those things?
I actually wanted to be a musician. A pianist, in fact. And I was a pretty good pianist. I could play some pretty intense stuff like Beethoven's Pathétique. But I was never great at it. Like, I was okay. And I feel like I was lucky because the town I grew up in, Quincy, it's a farm community. But it's also really artsy fartsy. And like every kid plays a musical instrument, like they have a, you know, in school thing and the Quincy Symphony Orchestra rivals like St. Louis's Symphony Orchestra.
Wow.
And like, and in fact, having heard them both at a young age, I liked ours better. And as a result, because they were actual good musicians all around me, I could see the difference in me and them.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, I'm not going to make it, you know, I'm nowhere near where these people are. But there was something I was good at because I was always the class clown. And of course, I thought that would translate into being an actor. And then you go away to school, and I had an excellent acting coach, Dennis Zajac, who's still very prominent in Chicago theater. He opened with other people, Victory Gardens Theater in Chicago, and he was amazing. And he was my acting teacher as a kid. And I mean, in college.
Yeah.
And I
That's a
learned so much from him,
kid.
you
That's a kid.
know.
That's a kid. College is a kid.
Yeah, but I also learned that I wasn't good at acting. I was good at comedy. And so in my junior year, because you do, you know, scenes, and I remember doing, somebody had cast me as like the mom or grandma or whatever, I don't even know, in Long Day's Journey Into Night, where she's a drug addict or some fucking
Wow,
thing.
yeah.
And, you know, I'm like 20, and I couldn't, I just felt awful doing it. And I had no idea if I was good or bad. None, zero idea if I was good or bad at what I was doing. I was giving it my best, but I was in way over my head. And not in a play, like in a directing scene. You know, it wasn't like I was like cast in an actual play. And man, I didn't want to feel that anymore. So I made a conscious decision to only do comedy from my junior year on, which included directing, which was, I learned so much. And I only directed comedy scenes. Like there's this scene. Okay, so he divided the work into like an action scene, a tender scene. What was this one? Suspense. Okay, suspense. And so for my suspense scene, I have Bert Lahr's notes on a car, or this John Lahr's notes on a cowardly lion about his father, the cowardly lion,
Right.
and Bert Lahr, and in the back of that book are sketches and stuff that Bert Lahr did either on Broadway and one that was on the Ed Sullivan Show. And I have a vague memory of seeing it as a kid, just vague. And it's Nancy Walker, if you remember her,
Yes, of course.
Nancy Walker and Bert Lahr. And it's a silent scene. Again, this was my suspense scene as a director. And they never speak. And it starts out with the wife sitting there at home, and the door flies open, and he steps in and he opens his lunchbox really loudly, pulls out a sandwich that has obviously one bite out of it, steps on the can, throws it in, the can lid slams, and there he goes. And then she does something to him. It's like back and forth like that for the entire scene. At one point, she's serving him dinner and she gets this big glop of food and it's like splop on his plate. Delicately
Right.
puts it on her own, you know. And the last bit of it is my favorite thing of all time. They're finally going to bed, right? They go all through dinner and they're finally going to bed. And she's in the bed already. And he sits on the end of the bed and he takes his shoe off and he throws it on the floor. And then he takes the other shoe, gently puts it silently on the floor. I thought that was the funniest thing. So that's what I did for my suspense scene.
It's
I
really
did
cool. I
that
love it. I love
thing
it.
and it was really fun. I mean, actually the set at the time was a house, an interior, you know, room with a house with a little kitchen and a thing. It was like, couldn't have been more perfect. You had to just work with what was on stage at the time, you know. Wow, I had so much fun. And so you had the option of opting out of one of the assignments. And I opted out of the like touching woo-hoo scene. I just didn't do it. I did
Right,
all
right.
comedy.
Great, wonderful. And so did you get kind of bit at that point when you directed and saw that you could produce something really funny and fun? And I
Yeah,
love
I had a I
dialogue.
did. I definitely did, but more of, for me personally, and I loved directing back then. I had a blast at it, but for me it, the feedback was more about me personally as a comedian, right?
Right.
That's the stuff that hooked me to the point where this is in recent years. I was in Chicago, it was probably like 10 years ago or whatever, but you know, now I direct a lot. And so and I love it in a way. I mean, I love it. It's a whole different, you know, hat to wear, and I really enjoy it. And I like working collaboratively, so it's fun.
And you have writing groups at the Fanatic that you work with, don't
Yeah, I
you?
have the WPA and we do all these shows. So like 10 years ago, I was sitting around with a friend of mine that I went to college with. We're still old friends. And I was talking about all this and she said this exact thing. And she said, you know, I was always amazed that you didn't end up being a director because don't you remember, she said, I'm like, huh. She goes, don't you remember that when one of your directing scenes was on that day, the whole the whole department came.
Wow.
And I'm like, yeah, you're right. I actually didn't really notice that at the time. But yeah, we always had a house for did a directing scene. So yeah, because I could find all these weird bits, and plus it was always comedy, right?
Right. Now, at that point, had you started writing comedy and sketches?
Yeah, I had done that in high school. When I was in high school, I had this friend Lynn Niewerner, who is now in my WPA workshop, writing in my workshop. And Lynn, I won't say she missed her calling, but what she did with her life is astonishing. She works she built assisted living homes and ran them, and my mother was a beneficiary of her work, and the lives she saved in her life, I can't tell you the improvements and help she gave people throughout her career, which was 40 years.
Wow.
It's like, well, comedy lost a good one because she's really funny. But yeah, we used to be the go-to people when someone was running for school office to run their campaign, because we would have a really funny campaign and they would get elected. We had like a reputation if we could have monetized it.
Always done like sketches and
Yeah,
scenes.
sketch. My first group out of college, I was in a group called the Unnatural Acts, and it was a sketch comedy group. And they were all 25, and I was the baby. I was 23. And they had a woman in the group that didn't want to do it anymore. Maybe she was moving or something, and they hired me. And they hired me solely on the voice of one person in the group, David Kovacs, who my friend Bonnie, the person who said, "I always thought you'd be a director," her, she had told David, well, we were working at the Crate and Barrel, all of us. Bonnie had quit by then. Dave and I were still working at the Crate and Barrel. And she goes, "She's like super funny and like talked me way up." He never saw me work. He didn't. He just took her word for it. And I'm like, "Yeah, I'm really funny, like whatever." And then the first night I did the show, I could see them all looking around like, "Where did you dig that up from?" Like, well, here's why. It was a sketch show and they were really fast changes. And you were kind of in every sketch, so you were just running the whole time. And my first time doing that, all I could think about was, am I where I'm supposed to be? I couldn't play. I was just like, guy, am I in the right sketch? Do I have my hat on? Like that. So they were like, oh, fuck, what have we done here? Next show, they were like, oh, we see why. We get it. And then from there on, we were all still friends. I mean, we just, that was a great group to be with. And we wrote a couple of shows together.
Do you remember the names of any of them?
The first show was already running. It was called Immaculate Reception. And as stupid as this sounds, it was, sketches if TV was in biblical times. It's kind of like the Flintstones, really. It was like the $10,000 pyramid was, an actual pyramid. And my favorite was Stay Tuned for My 12 Sons. But it was really funny. Those guys were funny. They were clowns. You know what I mean? The other woman in the group was a woman named Janice Carr. No one knows what happened to her. She was really a physical comic, really funny. Anyway, so we did that. And then we did another one called, what was it called? I can't think of the name of the other one. I think I have the poster for it out in my garage. I can't think of it, but it was a PBS send-up. And we
Now,
did Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and we did an opera.
had you ever studied sketch writing at all?
No.
It just came to
No.
you.
So when I got to Second City, I thought I knew what I was doing, both improvisationally, because at that point I had been improvising in front of audiences for several years nightly, you know what I mean? So I thought, I know what I'm doing. And then sketch-wise, yeah, Natural Acts, they were really good. So I'm like, yeah, I know how to do that. And then it took me a year to figure out that I actually didn't know that at all, what I was supposed to be doing, and another year to figure out what I was supposed to do. So, but I got it eventually.
One of the things that you and Jeff are really known for is the creation of the ETC at Second
Yeah.
City. Now, were you going through classes there before that? What's the chronology of that?
Well, now you're going to have to take this with an enormous grain of salt, what I'm about
Okay.
to say. Because when I got to Second City, I was in a improv group, and I had, so coming out of college, we had done so much great work, my pals and I, that we got, it's a long story how we ended up with this little theater, but there was an empty church and there was a theater group there, and they did a show, and they were just struggling because around, literally around the corner from where this church was St. Nicholas Theater. And David Mamet, brand new, right?
Wow.
St. Nicholas Theater, right around the corner. No way we could compete with that.
Right, right.
So one of the guys in the group proposed that we form a comedy group, an improv group. And I had never done improv because back when I was doing sketch, we were very arrogant about it. We were like, we write, you know, improvisers, whatever.
And we can memorize lines.
Yeah, we can work it out. But one of the guys that was in A Natural Acts was also doing a lot of improv at the time. And he had said to me, Mark Nutter, and he was my writing partner in college. And so so Mark was doing improv, and he said to me, you know, so great. Improv is so great because when you get a laugh, it's just yours. And I thought, well, that's just masturbation. Like, okay, well, once I did it once, I was hooked, right? He's right. It's your laugh. It's amazing. So, but it's also so the everything is built on the other person. So it's never like, anyway, it's just so great, right? We all know
it's
so,
never your own because you're working with a partner.
Because it wouldn't, yeah, because it's all collaborative. So you wouldn't have come to that line without that person saying this thing to you or you saying that thing to them. It just, you know, doesn't, anyway, that's why it's so great, really. And so we start, so what we did is we booked an act that had a following in Chicago, like a stand-up or something. And then we opened for them in a group called Moving Targets. And we never went anywhere. We played at our place, the Chicago Comedy Showcase on the corner of Diversey. And what was the cross street? Can't remember. And right next to Joe Perillo's car lot, empty church. And so people sat in pews and brought their own beer. But it was the only place in Chicago that had a great big stage. All the other stages were stand-up stages, little, you know, and improv groups played there, but you were like, burp, 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 and you had to alter what you do to fit there. We never bothered. We just opened our, you know, but because one guy in the group wouldn't let us go play anywhere else, and we all wanted to. And one day he quit, and we ran right out and played at Zany's, like, that week.
Wow.
And I met Jeff that night.
At Zany's.
I was on
was that
stage.
Historic meeting like?
That historic meeting. So Zany's was really weird. The stage was by the front door. Okay, so if you picture like a big rectangle, the bar is at the back, the stage is at the front, the door is here, and then there was a railing. So the audience is sitting here, and then you come in the door and you go all the way down here like this, and then around into the seating area. Maybe you get a beer on your way, boom, right? And I was on stage doing Story, Authors, actually, that game. I was in it, not conducting it. And somebody walked in, and all I saw was this person from the back walk up that aisle with a hat on. And so I saw nothing except the back of this person. And I did this thing like, I don't know why. It's like, remember in Nancy comics where she would see a dime on the, and there'd be a dotted line going for,
right,
that's
right.
What happened. Literally, I'm watching the conductor, but I've got a Nancy dotted line watching this guy walk, thinking, I wonder who that guy is. I don't know why. I couldn't tell you. And then when I got off stage, he was sitting at the back of the house, and he was a regular at Zany's. And he was in a group called the Original Comedy Rangers. It was all men. Well, sometimes it wasn't, but mostly it was. And at one point when I was at, during that same period of time, there was an article, for example, of the three best improv groups in Chicago. And it was his group, my group, and another group, right?
Wow.
In the paper. This, and or we'd all be playing a place, and this was once we were out and about, right? And they'd be there that week, and we'd be there the next week. Like, we never met. I never knew he existed. I never knew anything about, except what I read in the paper, right? And so anyway, I get off stage and he's at the back of the house having a beer. Well, Zany's had been a strip club back before all this. I worked at Crate and Barrel down there, two doors down from Zany's, when it was a strip club. And there was hookers hanging, like there would be like a barker in the doorway when you walk down the street during the day, going, "Come on in, come on in." And then there'd be like a hooker kind of standing behind him, scantily clad. So that's where the green room was, upstairs. And the upstairs, that upstairs room was like mirrors and red plush. Well, also at this time. So we went up there and started talking, and then, you know, everything was closing. So at this time, the Blues Brothers was shooting in Chicago, and they had opened a speakeasy, so to speak. So across the street from Second City, straight across the street, was a place called the Earl of Old Town, which was a really famous folk club. And then there was like a courtyard, and then like a craftsman style house in behind there. In that house, Belushi and Aykroyd took it over and put a pool table and a bar in there, and it was a 24/7 bar back there. And that's where Jeff took me that night, and the rest is history.
And you were familiar with Belushi, right, at that point in
Oh,
time?
sure, yeah, I knew that. But what had happened to me was, during the part where we were moving targets and we were only working at our own place, one of the guys in the group started making us go to sets at night at Second City. Now, what Second City does is you do the show, which is sketch, written sketch, when there's maybe a couple games in there, but sketch. And then they take suggestions and they do an improvised set. And that's how they work on the next show, right? Well, I had no idea what I was watching. I didn't know that it wasn't written. Even after seeing it nightly, I thought all of it was written. I had no clue. I was completely like, look. So my thing about Second City and who was where and who did what and where they were, I maybe know, but I don't know. So what was your question? You actually
How you got over to Second City, because you did a lot of other work before you were at Second
Right. So
City.
what happened, how I got to
A lot of
Second City?
work.
Yeah, how I got to Second City was, I was still at the Comedy Showcase, and Noni Breen Riley now, or Newton Briley, anyway, the Breens, Danny Breen and his wife, Noni, had seen me work, and there was somebody was leaving her move. Oh, she was, duh, she was. They were moving her to main stage, and she said, "I haven't seen anybody, you know, like you. You ought to be auditioning." And I auditioned with like a million other women, but yeah, I got hired. So and I was really terrified. Oh, I know what we're talking about like not knowing how to do the work, right? So I really, when I auditioned, I was so terrified. I thought I was going to die. And then I thought to myself, you do this all the time. You do it nightly. Just pretend you're just doing what you do and forget the stakes. And sometimes I think I was hired because they thought I was somebody else. Specifically, they thought I was Jane Voight, who is really funny, also a Chicago girl. So yeah, so Noni saw me do this thing, and I came in and did it.
I ask you a question because, they're Spolin based and games and all of that. Did you know any? I mean, you mentioned Story, but did you know a lot of the games they were
I'm the
doing?
game queen. I'm the game queen. I can teach you how to do games up what sign, down the other. That's all I did forever. I know the games backward and forward. They hold no interest to me whatsoever. I get it, and I don't have any problem with you doing games or anything. But for me, I need to be scared a little. I need more, you know, I can do that in my sleep. You know what I mean?
Flying without a net.
Yeah, I like to be really like, we're doing what? You know, I like that
Well, and the games, I think, prepare us, help teach people how to interact and how to listen, and they're, building blocks for a lot of us,
they
I think.
definitely are, and they've gone away. They used to be the teaching tools that everyone used, even to teach someone to do long form Harold and stuff like that. I used them when I was teaching Harold, you know, because for one thing, here's a thing that happens in a game, right? So say you have there's a game where you're on two teams, and the guy in front, right? You guys do a scene, you got these people behind you, get you do a scene. Then anytime I can tag out and take my actor out, but I'm playing the same character. And the and then that game, so it's a really fun game on both sides, right? You do that. And you find out a lot from that game, like if this guy is a woman and then a man starts playing him, they'll start playing to a man instead of, it's amazing how sexist we all are, is what I'm trying to say. And you have to go, ah, and so what I would do is tell them, tag your thing back to remind them who that character is and what they look like. So they have the imagination to draw it to the other person, right? Then we started playing it where I can add a character on my team, and now I can tag out either one of them. And we played that as a long form. And honestly, the only thing, and what I would do is like, sometimes it would be like, well, we need a rule for that, right? Like we need to do it. And for me, it was always the actors would always be like, oh, you know, we had to make a rule that la la. I'm like, no. We don't need to make more rules. And so the only rule to that game was you can only tag from your own team, because we found out, and I don't know why this is, that no matter what happened and who you switched out with over on your team, if you cross-pollinated and tagged out somebody on the other team, we were lost.
That's
Audience
funny.
of players,
That's
we were
funny.
all lost. I don't know why that was, but that turned out to be true.
So you
So
weren't doing swipes or any of that.
yeah, no, you just tag and you know, boom. And I didn't even know at that point about time dashes and stuff like that. This was so long ago. None of that stuff. So I used a lot of the game, and I was talking about this with somebody about the yes and thing. I saw a moment of a podcast I did, and yes and why it's important. And it is important, but it's not the be all and end all, right?
Well, in this podcast, but the same one I was listening to, Viola Spolin didn't never mentioned yes and.
No, that's Joe. Yeah.
That's Joe Fosberg. Yeah. So, and what are your thoughts about the yes and?
Well, my thoughts about the yes and are the same. It's like, no, it's not the be all and end all. And you absolutely get to say no. And here's my thing about yes and. You can't make a habit of saying no, A. You have to stay with the ongoing activity, even if you don't want to do it. Your character can say, no, I don't want to rob a bank. But he damn well be robbing that fucking bank. Right? So he can protest the entire time, but he better do the ongoing action. So, I mean, that's a kind of lame example, but you get the picture, right? And but what happens when you're teaching brand new people, I'm not sure it's just a human thing. It's not like, oh, any particular person is this way. Like, kind of everybody is. Their go-to response when they're first on stage for the first time and somebody says something to them is to say no. And I do think that it's maybe because we're so inundated with when whatever we're watching always has conflict, right? So you think, oh, I'm in a scene, I should make conflict. I think that's what it comes from, or fear, right? I don't know if I say yes, what'll happen, right?
And conflict's a really important word because a lot of early people, I think, get into conflict and arguments that go
Yes.
nowhere.
That go
And
nowhere.
instead of being a relationship, even if you don't totally like the person, you're in a relationship with the person. You're not strangers when you're doing a scene.
Yes.
So, what do you think about conflicts and argument, Jane? I gave you my opinion, but.
Well, that's totally my opinion. And I look this up. I mean, you can't explore anything if you're arguing. You're just arguing. And yeah, and con there's I swear I read this and then I went looking for it and couldn't find it. But in Viola's book, there's a chapter called Conflict. I swear it's in there. And she's writing to Paul saying, I'm thinking about taking conflict out of the work because it just makes for psychodrama. And he writes back and he says, and this is what I always felt, but I never had it validated. You know what I mean? By like the Bible of improv, like we all need the Bible, right? If Viola said it, then it's correct, right? But he says, yeah, I took it out a long time ago. That's what he says. Just, yeah, go, it's gone. I don't do that. And I'm like, oh, thank God. What a relief. What a relief. Because what is conflict anyway? If you're going to be doing in scenes, then you've got plot.
Right.
Really? You want to try to play a plot? Oh,
That's
don't.
your knee story, right? And you're out of your
Yeah.
head at the
Oh,
moment. You're
yeah,
not
don't
being
do that.
present.
It's very, very tiring.
But when
So,
you go ahead.
no, that's all. I mean, so that's my thing is that, well, Viola said it too. Yay.
Yay, Bio. Yeah, she said a lot of wonderful things. She was so ahead of her time. I just was actually going to drop some names. When you got to Second City, was Joyce Sloan still there?
Yes.
I heard she was an incredible person.
She was an incredible person.
Really took care of the cast and the students
And
and
beyond, like she would find somebody that she thought was good, but maybe they weren't good enough. Like they couldn't hire them for whatever reason, or she wasn't alone in the hiring, you know, sometimes. Then she would find some other thing for them. She would find them little gigs or whatever. She just, yeah, she was a mom. I mean, when Second City, when I was there, it was a mom and pop organization. And in the true sense of that word, it was like mom and dad, Bernie and Joyce and Uncle Fred, Fred Kaz. Yeah.
Yeah, I heard he was an incredible person, an incredible player, piano
He,
player.
I can't say enough about Fred. And Second City wouldn't be what it is without him because of what he brought to how they worked, because he was a jazz musician. And he elevated their work at all times. And for me, the same. And in when I first got there, he was at the piano. And I was he early on when I was there for like 10 years. He would sometimes after a show play for a while, just sit and play. And it was like heaven because he was amazing. And I would sit and listen to him and just think, if I could just even talk to that guy, I would be happy. And he became one of my closest friends and allies in my life.
Oh, that's beautiful. What a
So, yeah,
fantastic
it was incredible.
friend. Yeah.
We really, really were close. And I miss him still.
Yeah,
And
people
it's
think
been 10 years since he died. Yeah.
is it 10 years now? You were
Yes.
at your
And
co-stars
Rick.
in a film you can't get anywhere, the film noir thing
Oh,
and
yeah. Why? Dan, Deb, please. Everyone wants to see the movie.
we do
Yeah.
want to see the movie.
It's
Yeah.
really good. I was shocked.
It was wonderful. I loved it so much. Your character was great. Everything was great. But I want to get back to jazz because I have taken some classes with your husband, Jeff, and he loves to play some music before we get into something, and it's jazz, and it really helps the flow of a scene, I think. He's a pretty good teacher, too.
A little bit, do you think?
A little bit.
Well, when I said, remember earlier I said like I didn't know what I was doing when I got to Second City at all. It took me all that time to figure it out. I learned through him. He got it. We were in these workshops. Oh, I know why we started talking about all that stuff is the workshop thing. I never had any improv workshops or almost none. Like one with Rob Riley, and I went to a couple Dell classes that had like 30 people in them. And at the time, Dell was doing this thing called slow comedy, which I understand why he did it because everybody was getting all glib all the time and just blah, 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 funny. And he wanted them to shut the fuck up and play. And so he would not allow them to talk until he told them to. And but it went on, and it was horrifying to watch and do. It was awful. But the point was well taken, mind you. But Anyway, I had almost nothing when I got there. And Second City at the time, and this is where I'm not sure, I think the only thing there for training was Jo Forsberg. And I don't think she was, she had a children's theater thing that did shows on Sundays.
Right.
But I'm not sure where her workshop was. I don't think it was at Second City, but I don't really know. Anyway, people would go to everybody that I know, from George Went to, I think George, Danny and Jeff, and all went to Joe. They all worked with Joe. Jeff was lucky enough to also work with Paul. But Joe's workshop was the place in Chicago. That was pretty much it. And then the Second City didn't start their workshop program until the ETC was well underway when that started.
Now they have conservancy and levels and like
Oh,
you
yeah, that was gross.
yeah, you know, like you can't do anything until you've attended like level 95 or something.
Exactly. And when they started it, they had a thing and they had five levels and you graduated and that was the end. And they saw what a cash cow it was and they started adding levels immediately. So that by the time we got out here and Jeff put the workshop program together for them out here, you know, it really went took off out here. It was like fire because, you know, the only thing going at that point professionally was the groundlings, right? So everybody flew over to Second City. Everybody who had ever been rejected by the groundlings showed up. You know, it was like, and we had the same thing. We started a place called Upfront, and the reason we called it Upfront was because of that. And we didn't have levels at all. And you could go to, if you signed up for a class, you could go to any of the other classes and audit. And if I had room to put you on stage, I would. We did the opposite. Like, get stage time. That's the only way you learn. You need stage time. So we did the opposite thing when we started Upfront. And then we had Upfront comedy for quite a while out here.
Oh. Well, let's go back to the founding of ETC and how that affected the Second City scene.
Well, it's a Rashomon of a story, I think, if you ask people who did it. But we were okay. So this particular touring company I was in, which was me and Jeff and Bill Applebaum and Jim Fay, I'm trying to think who was actually on the road with us at that time, were the company. And when we were on the road at that point, Bernie, you were mostly hired out of the tour co to be on main stage. And that was it. Your life at Second City was either in tour co, because they didn't have a workshop program, in tour co or on main stage. There were six actors on main stage. And so the rest of us all just waited for one of them to die, right? And then what happened is the road was grueling, really. It was a grueling thing. I won't get into that much, but it was fun. Like, we all enjoyed each other's. We are still all friends. But it was a grueling thing. And so we were auditioning all the time for main stage. And every time we did, Bernie would have a different criteria. Like, he wanted you to be able to do make a song, or he wanted this that time, or this time he wanted you to do all kinds of accents or whatever. They became known as Bernie's bake-offs. We call them Bernie's bake-offs. And we were always overlooked, all of us. And he'd bringing in actors from New York and every damn place. And we were very, very bitter. At this point, we had been on the road almost 3 years. And that's tough. And so we were called Bitter Co. And a very appropriately named Bitter Co. But what we started to do, and I was a real ringleader on this front, is it was like, look, we came to Second City to write and perform our own material. That's why we're here. Why are we letting them stop us from doing that? So we started writing our own material on the road and putting our scenes in where, when you're on the road with Second City, you do old Second City scenes and you have the entire history of Second City to choose from. So you've got a great show, right? Always. But we started replacing scenes with our own work. Well, at the same time, now this is where I get really fuzzy. So Paul Sills built a stage behind Second City to do Story Theater. Jeff was in that show.
Wow.
Then practical theater, which had Julia Louis-Dreyfus and Brad Hall and Paul Burroughs and Gary Kroger, all who went to SNL, was back in, not Paul Burroughs, I don't think he went. Anyway, they were back there doing their show, and their show was amazing. The practical theater was stellar. Before that, Julia was actually in our touring company. Julia was the other woman in the 6-person cast, 4 men, 2 women. So then Julia went on to greatness, as we all know, and she was a stellar, oh my God, that girl was good. Wow, was she good. She was very young then too. She couldn't have been. She was 19, 21. I don't know, man. She was so good. And so we loved her. Anyway, we said to them, well, how come they get to do a show back there? Why don't we get to, why don't you do your, so we were supposed to do a Turco show, best of, right? And we just kept replacing scenes out of that show till we had a show. And then Joyce, Bernie didn't want us to do a show back there. He felt that he was competing with himself by having a original show back there. And Joyce saw what it could be. And so Bernie would go on these archaeological digs. And Joyce, and there was this guy named Ted Donner, who was the house manager up front there. So Second City in the front is the offices and the front bar, and then the main room. And then in the back, in the alley, is the Second City ETC with a bar. There's a back bar too. So there's a bar there. And she would send Ted from the front office back to where we were rehearsing with information. You need to get a press release out by this date. Here's what has to go in a press release. You need to da da da. She did all this, right? She was like Sergeant Schultz. I see nothing. I see nothing. And that's what she did. And we opened that show, and Bernie was pissed off. It was a big hit. Cows on Ice. Dan Castellaneta was in it. It was a big hit. Maureen Kelly, Bill Applebaum, me and Jeff. I think Carrie Goldenberg was in that. Susan Gauthier. And did we have 3 women then? I know we had Mo. Anyway, and Carrie Goldenberg, and who am I forgetting? Steve Sheridan was in that company, the early company, maybe by the second one. Anyway, so we do this. We open the show, Bernie's pissed. Then he goes in a next archaeological dig, and we do it again. And at this point, and this is a true story that doesn't sound true, he was in a cab coming home from the airport. When, and there's a newspaper on, it's not his newspaper, somebody's newspaper on the seat of the cab, open to our rave review of our second show.
I love it. I love it.
He gets pissed. He's like, what? And he calls on the big giant phone. They had the giant phone in the cab. And said to Joyce, fire them all. And she showed him the bar receipts. And that was the end of that. Because we were selling out. I remember one night when Phil Donahue and the wife came. What's her name?
Marla
came. Marla Thomas was there. But yeah, we had luminaries coming left and right. It was something else. So we did 5 shows with them, and then they wanted to bring the last show we did there. I directed, and I did the okay. So mind you, Second City was 4 men, 2 women. And it was like a formula, a pretty woman and a character woman.
Right.
And then a fat guy, a smart guy, a blue collar guy, and a clown. That was the formula. And we obviously broke the mold in the back, because for one thing, you know how Joyce didn't like to fire anybody? When somebody didn't work out on main stage, often we would end up with them. And sometimes that didn't work out either, but sometimes it did. And so our cast got bigger. We didn't have 6 people. We had 7, you know, like we had whatever. I think at one point we might have had 8. And anyway, I did a show. My show that I directed had 4 women, 4 and 3 men.
Cool. I love it. I love
and
it.
That never happened before, and I never got credit for it. And it really bothers me. In fact, I have read in those books the first time a recent cast did that, and they're like, this is the first. I'm like, really?
Yeah.
Really? 1989.
Wow.
1988, actually, that show went up.
Wow.
1988, that's when that was.
Yeah, you mentioned gender, and we're talking about, you know, the preferential team with the men outnumbering the women and the assigned kind of parts for the women. And there used to be a thing saying, you know, women can't be funny, which we know is an utter lie. That's a myth, okay? But
It's
have you
Dell. That was
noticed?
a Dell thing.
It was, he was a
Yeah.
misogynist.
Oh.
Yeah, as, among other things. I mean, a brilliant mind, but you know, he had
Yep.
some
No one's
issues.
perfect.
Yeah. But what was your experience working with this when you start working with more and more women? Because I know like WPA is women, right?
It
You're
tends to be because guys don't like to ask for directions, I guess.
So the difference in working with, you know, you've worked with some incredible people, wonderful, you know, talented people, but working, can you make a distinction between working with men and women?
Well, for me, maybe it's a little different. First of all, when I got to Second City, basically your roles were mother, sister, whore, kind of. We used to joke about that. And when I had that cast, with four women and three men, the men, when they realized there's only three of them and four women, freaked out. And they're like, "What?" And I said, "No, don't you get it? You'll get to do more. Actually, not
Right.
less." And that proved to be true. And we had a ball. I mean, we had a ball during that show. And so, you think that right away. But for me, because I never fit the mold of mother, sister, or whore. You know what I mean? I'm a clown. I am a clown. And so I play like the guy. I play like the guys play. And so I don't, for me, it's not the people that I had trouble with were people that were misogynists and couldn't deal with me not doing what they expected me to do.
Right.
Or whatever their expectations were, I didn't meet them. And I didn't give a shit. So obviously we're not going to get along. But there's tons.
I'm wondering about the differences you find when you're working with almost all females versus a heavy male-laden cast,
Yeah.
and what your experience is with that.
Well, for me, we used to do, for example, when I first started doing Harolds and learned how to do Harolds, which I love, we had we it was a kind of a lottery thing. So we had a bunch of people, say 15, 20 people, and you would pull number one through four out of a hat. So that was the group you were in, number one, two, three, or four, right? So you knew everyone you were playing with. But you didn't know what configuration of them it would be. And often the guys would be like, "Well, we need a woman, or we need, our group turned out to be all guys. We need a woman." And I'm like, "No, you need a good player. You need a good player in your group. It could be a woman or not, right? But you don't need, why do you need a woman so you can do misogynistic scenes?" I really
Exactly. And you know,
I don't even understand that mentality. You know what I mean?
I've heard there are some improv schools that don't want people to play other genders, and I don't get that because I love playing a man.
Oh, well, I would say this, the one thing, and I don't disagree with you, and I have no problem with people playing other genders. I don't. But I did for then a long time have this all women group, the All Girl Review, that a bunch of us did, that was, and we had, none of us had ever done an all women group before. And this was kind of like in the 2000s, I think. Oh, later than that, because it was like 2005 or six, I think, when we started, 2007. Anyway, we had this all women group, and we all were like, "Wow, this is a whole different energy. That's really cool that I can't quite put my finger on, like what, why, how it's different, but it is." And it's not because women are less aggressive, or it's just, I don't know
Right.
what it is. It's just a different energy. And so I, that was kind of enlightening to me that that would be the case. And in that group, the girls play men sometimes. But for me, and this is just me, the thing I really liked about playing in the all-girl group was all the roles you could play that didn't involve being a man. Can't we explore all the roles women can play in life? You know what
yes,
I mean?
Yes, 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 yes.
And that's why I said to them, I would never tell you not to play a man, but I think it's more interesting when we don't. That's all. And if you want to play a man, go for it. And of course they do. I don't care. I'm not going to hold a player back from what their brain is doing.
But in terms of, you know, there used to be a riddle, and the punch, it was about a doctor saving somebody, but the punchline was the doctor was a woman. And that was a surprise because, you know, there weren't that many women doctors or whatever. And those kind of stereotypical female positions and characters that we think of instead of being an astronaut or a physics scientist. Yeah.
Whatever you are, it could be a woman. So the only time you're going to have to be other gender, and you don't even have to do that, or is there like relationshipy stuff, heterosexual relationshipy stuff, right? That's the only way it, I don't know, unless you're exploring gender stuff in, say, an office environment. I don't know. But yeah, I never play men, at least not on purpose, unless somebody casts me that way. But it's not like exactly a judgmental thing. It's just like an exploration kind of thing, really.
Right. But you have an incredible energy because I have seen you perform now. Your physicality is amazing. I was in awe of it. The way you move.
It's the clown.
And that's the clown, yeah. That's great. Well, let's go back to now. You're still at Second City. ETC is doing really well. And then where does Jay Morris go? What happened?
Oh, well, they wanted to bring that show out that I had to direct with the four women and three men out here, but they didn't bring that cast and they ended up not bringing that show. And that's why things kind of broke down and got weird. So, and then they, after a, not a, about a year, I think they fired me. From out
in,
here, Second
in
City.
LA.
When
did you come to LA, Second City?
89.
LA. Okay.
Yeah. So like the following year, I think. Yeah. The following year, they fired me. And they brought Jeff out to direct and they let him do the first show and they wanted to rotate directors, which was not a good idea because we had finally all gelled and then they blew up the cast and director. It's like, we got to start all over now. What do you, anyway. I was gone anyway, so that's when we started up front.
Okay. And was that on the west side, like the Fanatic?
Yeah, it was on the west side. It was in Santa Monica, and it was before the Promenade had become a thing, but it was becoming a thing. And we found this empty Mexican restaurant, and they gave us a month-to-month lease. And
it
never stopped. We had a really low rent in this month-to-month lease, and we gutted this restaurant and built this little theater in there. Everybody helped, like so many people helped, I can't tell you. Actors and improvisers and, you know, we were teaching workshops and all that. And it was just an amazing thing and built itself in a way. And then that building, we were still there, like our month-to-month lease never went away until that great big earthquake, the Northridge earthquake, destroyed that building. And well, not destroyed it, but you know, we couldn't, it fell apart and they had to redo it. So then we moved around the corner and we were there for like another 7 years, I think. It was a long haul with Upfront. And then now we have the Fanatic Salon.
Which was a beauty salon at one point.
It was the hair Fanatic Salon. And we just placed the word hair and...
And it's a great theater. When I saw it in person, it is a little bit of a small stage.
Very small. Well, the stage is actually pretty big. It's, you know, we have shows on there that have like 20 people in them. And I've had shows that were actual plays with a million people in them. And we managed to pull that off. And we don't really have a backstage to speak of.
No.
Or any storage space whatsoever.
It's great. It's wonderful. It's just, I saw so many great improvisers the nights that I was there, like
Yeah, that was
our friend
fun.
Jay Succo and Will Hines and Bill Cott and Michelle Gilliam. And your host is so many great actors and improvisers there. I guess Ed Asner used to stop by too, didn't he, with
He did a couple
Michael
times
Golding?
for different things. One was a staged reading from Mark Larson's book, Ensemble. He came for that. And where else did I see him there? He was there a couple of times, yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, when you, I heard you on this other podcast talk about things improvisers don't want to hear. One of them was about the yes and. I'm trying to remember what some of those other things were that people don't like it when I say this or that. Do you have any idea what I'm
Don't.
speaking of right
I
now?
don't. Yes, and is the one that pops to mind. The recent controversy, if it even is one, was somebody wrote a thing about not liking the Herald, or the Herald's overrated, or we should let the Herald go. It's not that great thing. And I'm like, yeah, no, that's you're just wrong. That's just wrong. Sorry.
Now you're still an active actor too, right? Let's see. You've
Yes.
been in so many things, and you were in Veep. Did you get a chance to reconnect with Julia when you were on
No, I
Veep?
didn't. And that bothered me. That really bothered me that I didn't get to. She wasn't in the on the set that day, and no.
I know that the laundromat was a fantastic experience. You were great in that.
Thank you.
Although
That
you
was a
did
fantastic experience.
You did die kind of early on.
I did. But Jeff got to go on.
Yeah, that was great. So is Jeff in Poland now?
No, he's right here in my living room. He's
Oh,
waving at me.
I thought I saw a shadow moving in the back. I thought it
It's
was like
him.
the
He's
shadow
moving
or
around.
something moving around. He's paying attention to what we're saying.
Yes, he's in
Hello.
interjecting things I should say.
Well, he should
He's
just come
leaving
on
now,
in,
though.
Jeff. Oh, Jeff, don't come in. Come on in. This is a
Then say
family
hi.
affair.
There he is.
Say
Hello.
hi, Jeff.
Oh, hello.
Hi, Jeff. Great to see you.
There's all these little details that pop up that, like, we had to go through City Hall to get our licensing at the, up front, and it was Christmas Eve that we went in, and we had a meeting where they're about to shut us down, and then they didn't. It's because we had about, I don't know, 40 people from up front that each wanted to speak about
Why we should be
why
there.
we should be there, and we won. And so we started cleaning the place out in October or something,
Yeah, we opened around Christmas time.
and Christmas Eve, we had to go to a meeting, or maybe the day before Christmas Eve, because they're about to shut us down,
Yeah.
deny us
Oh.
entry.
Again, we didn't wait for permission. That's our motto.
Right.
We
Right. Right.
don't wait to, actors are the people that wait to be invited. Cut that out.
No gatekeepers. And that's my problem with most of the improv places, is that they're all gatekeepers. I don't stop anybody from coming to my class. I don't make it part of a program. It's
You don't have to do a level to get to that level. To,
Right.
and then when people keep
Yeah.
talking about levels, I go, Farley walked in the door at Second City and was hired 4 months later. So where's your levels? Where's
Right.
your levels? There are
Right.
levels.
Yeah, and somebody could have a lot of experience and take a lot of classes, and they're not really a good improviser, and somebody can walk in that's never done it before and they're brilliant. I
That's right.
mean, you
That's
just
right.
don't know.
So making
There's
levels at institutions is, it's a ripoff. It's a con. So if you have to stay anywhere for X number of years, it's a
just
con.
go to Scientology, you'll be happy.
Yeah, you can do that's the fastest way. That's the fastest way to lose your money.
Jeff, I'm going to ask you, and maybe just a few sentences. What could you say about Jane Morris's contribution to improvisational theater?
Oh, well, there's so many, but key ones was she established power as a player that how do you phrase it, that transcends sexuality or gender or anything. She helped other women claim the stage. She was the star of all of our ETC shows. Not that she's trying to make herself, she just was the best actress of us. Turned out to be a great director as well. She just independence is really something that she personifies, and hilarious takes on deep subjects. So her characters seem very broad, but very believable and able to uncover very deep stuff because they're so funny.
Well, thank you. You know, my mom always said she was always an independent little cuss.
I would say fiercely independent because you didn't let things and institution and people get in the way.
Yeah, but I was always like that. Like I was a kid too, I was like that.
Yeah. So that should be the foreword of the book on Jane that you gave us just
I'm
now,
a
too.
walking yes and.
And how do two actors have a successful marriage? I know you go to Poland a lot, you travel a lot, Jeff,
Well, that's
but
just recent though, that it's the last 3 years that he's been traveling like that. Most of the time I'm stuck with him.
We were we raised kids, and that's a very important kind of thing. I don't know how good we were at it, but we did our best. And I don't think either of us knew what this, except from maybe our really bizarrely different parental structures.
I grew up in a Norman Rockwell painting.
And I
He
grew
did
up
not.
in a crazy place. So
Right.
I think that we just there's an allowance for idiosyncrasies and for traumas of various sorts, particularly on my end, and that
I also
it
think that.
didn't scare Jane away, I know.
Well, I also think that because we see eye to eye artistically almost all the time, I think that goes a long way in, we don't always, but a lot, mostly we do. I mean, like the levels thing and the gatekeeper stuff and all that stuff. I can't tell you how many people hated that we don't have levels. I can't tell you. I mean, it's people like gatekeepers, I guess. I don't know what that is, but
Well, they're afraid that they're going to be playing with someone that's going to just
they're
make.
not good enough for whatever. You know, I get it, but it's just so weird. So as soon as somebody starts talking to me about levels, I'm out. And or syllabuses, frankly. I don't mind a guideline syllabus, but if you're telling me, you know, during the course of like Second City has like a thing, here's what you teach this time and this time. Well, what if just like you come into class and today they're just not listening? They can't, you got to get them, you can't follow the damn syllabus. It's like, no, today they don't need that. So here's what they need today. Anyway, so we see eye to eye on so many things that way. I think a lot of people who are like actors that are together that, and that doesn't work out. It has to do with their egos and it has to do with artistic differences.
Competition and
And we're just not like that. So,
I think what I see is not the yes and, but the acceptance. We have acceptance of our partner. We have acceptance of the reality of the scene. And if we accept that our partner is going to have flaws and we can accept them without trying to change them, without trying to play right how I want you to be or how I want you to perform in terms of, you know, what our household duties are. And I think that really makes for a successful marriage, but.
I also think that in improv terms, one of the, you know, how we were talking earlier about how when people start, they do say no a lot. They also try to fix the other player and not, but it's not out of like something's wrong. It's like, it's a basic human thing that if you tell me a problem, I'm going to try to help you, which isn't good scenically. Right? So we don't try to fix each other either. We try to help.
Yeah, I think it's more fun in improv to let the person have the problem and help magnify the
Absolutely. That's,
problem. We
yes.
can't fix it. We're going to make it. We're right. You aren't dumb or whatever.
Yeah, you're a dummy. Oh, play a dummy? That's so much fun.
That's wonderful. Well, what a treat to see both of you.
I'm supposed to be at a television meeting right now.
Well, go.
So I have to go.
Go, you.
Well, I got to say, one thing about coming to California is I didn't get to take Jeff's workshop on a Saturday. That would have been a lot of fun. But next trip.
Okay. Yeah, next time for sure.
All right.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, bye, Jeff.
He's working on a show these days, so.
Oh, great. TV show, you mean?
Well, yeah, they're working to get it going, and it's a political thing, so they're working before the election to get it going.
Cool. So what a wonderful, I put a note to you just now, and...
Yes, the answer is yes.
And what a wonderful, wonderful time I'm having with you. We're going to just have to make this a more frequent experience, not only to talk about improv philosophy, but to teach me to be a better improviser, because that's why I started these podcasts. I wanted to learn from really great improvisers. And Jane, you certainly are a great improviser, a great person, a funny mind. I can't tell you, when we met in person, I know I'm kind of starstruck, but I was like, so, oh my gosh, I'm hugging you.
That's so crazy.
It's a lot of fun. So thank you again. And do you want to, in closing, is there anything you'd like to share with the multitude of listeners we have on
don't
our
wait to be
podcast?
Invited. That's my thing. Don't wait to be invited.
Don't wait to be invited. That's beautiful advice. Thank you so much, Jane.
All right. Thank you. It's been a pleasure as always.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast and look forward to you joining us next time on Improv Interviews with Margot Escott.